I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd talk a little bit about the situation in Korea that happened about a week ago. Austin, since you wrote a piece on that most recently, do you want to give us sort of the background and what's currently happening there?
Oh, yeah. What's been going on over the last, well, you can go back to the 1990s to see the roots of what amounts to a South Korean diplomatic victory. It's not huge. It has real implications, and I'll just leap to the conclusion. Dictatorships are brittle constructs, Dan. Doesn't mean that they aren't strong, doesn't mean that they can't enforce their will, doing it through brutality, but part of it is they rely on the perception that they cannot be challenged. And South Korea pursued, well, in various forms, it pursued sunshine policies, though not with that name per se, where when North Korea would bully them or commit an atrocity, and I use that word with intent, a violent, provocative act of war, but remember there's all this quasi-war continuing. You just had a long-term ceasefire. There's no end, quote-unquote, to the Korean War. And several times North Korea has even said that it's, you know, ending, breaking the ceasefire agreements. But South Korea would be very measured in its responses. So there's a perception that North Korea could act with impunity. South Korea has some very powerful friends, the United States, despite the enmity between Japanese and Koreans, Japan, and it's also South Korea has developed very solid relationships throughout the world. It's no accident, really, that Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, is a South Korean. South Korea is a major economic success. It's also a cultural success. And in that column, I made a little joke about Psy, the Korean comedian and rapper who had that mega hit Gangnam Style, 3 years ago that ended up with hundreds of millions of views. I think it was more than exceeded a billion. Somebody can check on it of the funny video that he made along with it. But all of those add up to intense jealousy on North Korea's part. Ugly, hideous dictatorship that willfully starves its own populace, operates as an organized crime gang because it's engaged in smuggling, develops nuclear weapons so that it can run an extortion racket. And elements of that sunshine diplomatic policy that I just mentioned a moment ago played right into the extortion racket because North Korea would threaten nuclear immolation of South Korea, Japan primarily, but also the United States. By the way, Austin, Texas showed up on a targeting list. Samsung has a major facility here in Austin. So that's a lot of people were puzzled by that. I wrote a column immediately saying, no, of course, this fits right in with if you understand that dictatorship and really how uneasy it is and how it's aware that it's lost the economic and cultural competition with the South. By the way, Jim wrote a very funny update about you pronounce that Choco, Jim? Or
yes.
Choco? Yeah, I thought so. I'll let him talk about that, the South Korean snack food that North Koreans just love. And that's just indicative, Dan, of what I mean by a cultural and economic success. But trolley up to 2010, I think it was March of 2010, when a North Korean naval commando team launched a sneak attack on the Chonan, which was a corvette, small warship. 46 sailors died. I have been in the National War Museum in Seoul, and when I was there in 2012, there was a little Well, it was really a memorial, Dan. It was a little display about the Chonan. It was over in a corner of in one of the major entrance ways. I mean, you could it was a very little solemn display, but you could see almost I would say 40 out of the 46, if not more, looked like they were age 22 or less, and that made a mark on Korea's younger generation. There had been a division there that was somewhat exploited by the North, of saying, this is all the defense of South Korea is all American imperialism and South Korean fascism and all the usual propaganda garbage. Well, maybe it's not. Maybe that regime in Pyongyang is absolutely insidious, vicious, and look what they did. Now, I mark that attack because there were plenty of South Koreans that argued for a stronger line against the North, but there were other incidents within a few months, artillery attack on a island, a South Korean island, that basically the heavy artillery from the North blew up a supermarket. I mean, that's what, what a heck of an attack. And this was caught on a cell phone video by a citizen living on the island. South Korea had enough, and so what became official policy was to plan for long-term reunification. That just incited the North. But it was actually very wise. South Koreans said, we're going to start putting away money in a fund. We can't afford to rebuild them like the West Germans rebuilt the East Germans. Not right now. We're afraid of it. That's something else Jim can talk about. It is a dimension of Korean reunification. But if we carefully put money away, whenever these guys collapse, we'll have the money to rebuild it, and as we reunify the peninsula. And that's also that sense of very strong diplomatic message that just riled the Kim regime. So that brings us up to now. You've got increasing militancy. Maybe that's the increasingly forceful counter responses by South Korea. I use the term tailored and measured responses that mirror North Korean aggression. In other words, you shoot at us, we shoot at you. And the implied reaction to putting landmines around a South Korean guard post in the southern half of the DMZ, which is what they did, and to August 4th, two South Korean soldiers tripped these landmines, and one lost one leg, the other one lost both of his legs. They were, they're maimed for life. The implicit statement not made is, you do this kind of infiltration, then we're going to turn it on you, which is something the South has pretty much avoided. And the North touts that it infiltrates the southern positions and even slips commandos into South Korea all the time. The second thing is the South started using a loudspeaker system along the DMZ, broadcasting regular Korean newscasts, according to the two English language sites I read, and of course there's a commentary on that. Some propaganda type statements about how crooked the North is, but also some entertainment. And I wasn't able to run down what the entertainment was, so I made a joke in the column about that. This is psychological warfare. Well, it is, but it's Psy War if they played Gangnam Style, which there's no doubt in my mind that Gangnam Style was a hit in North Korea. I mean, China was rocking out to that. The South Koreans were overtly touting their economic success, and part of that economic success is what has influenced China. So I've said this increasingly forceful South Korean response. Background is China. China has been propping up North Korea. But you notice that, and I'll, Jim can speak to this more knowledgeably than I, the Chinese current economic situation is, I guess, a fair way to describe it, is in flux. They need all the reliable trading partners that they can have. South Korea is a major Chinese trading partner, just like Japan, just like the United, just like the United States. China does not need a war on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea was caught, and based on what I've, like, again, this was international press, but some of this out of the South Korean press, the U.S. and China behind the scenes were encouraging negotiations. In other words, China wasn't backing up North Korea. Its support was, you know, I said tepid. Well, okay, that's probably less than tepid, given that what the North ultimately did. Now, U.S., we did forward deploy some B-2 bombers to Guam. That sends a message because the B-2 can deliver the massive ordnance penetrator, which is a threat to, you know, knock out the regime leaders hiding in their bunkers. But that's kind of a subtle threat. And North Korea in negotiations, as Jim pointed out in a strategy page post, started introducing all kinds of other things instead of just talking about the landmine incident. As Jim speculated, that's not speculation, this is what's going on. They're trying to squeeze some success out of what, as they know, is a looming defeat. South Korea had demanded that the North apologize, and they want the soldiers who laid the landmines punished. And North Korea finally said they regretted the incident. Well, I can't find an incident, an example of anything like this. The North says it's not an apology. Plenty of people in South Korea say it's not apology enough for two soldiers being, you know, attacked and losing their legs. But South Korean diplomats and anybody who's watched this know this is a big come down for the North. They're forced to take responsibility for a sneak attack, an ugly incident. They've gotten nothing out of it. Even though the South says, we'll continue to talk. We'll be glad to talk. There was a published just yesterday a list of things that South Korea, in face-to-face negotiations with the North, said, yeah, we're willing to explore these things. But I'll turn it over to Jim at this point, because South Korea explores these issues, Dan, from a position of strength. North Korea doesn't. All it's got is, you know, its army and its nukes that may or may not work, and they face increasingly stiff opposition from a Japan that's moving to an offensive, openly offensive capability, which would include taking out North Korean threats. A South Korea increasingly capable of acting on its own to take out North Korean threats, and both are backed up by the United States, which certainly has the strategic assets to stop, you know, if we decide to act, North Korea's so-called ace card, which is its nukes. So South Korean increased South Korean forceful responses, lack of Chinese support, humiliation for the North. I'll leave it there, Dan.
Jim, what are your thoughts?
Well, this comes at the end of a long, several years worth of China slowly ratcheting up the pressure. The Chinese have a different attitude towards, you know, problems like North Korea. The Chinese take the long view, and when the United States asks them to do something right away, 9 times out of 10, the Chinese will look at it and say, look, there's no need for an immediate action. We would like to wait. I mean, that's just a different style of politics. They plan long term, you know, centuries. They talk about generations and what have you. Anyway, as we reported in Strategy Page over the last, especially the last year, but the last couple of years, actually, there have been more and more incidents of China basically slapping, insulting North Korea. Now, often it's done unofficially. I mean, we pick up a lot of, you know, human intelligence coming out of China. especially northeastern China, where the North Korean border is. There are a lot of foreigners up there, you know, businessmen, what have you. There's a lot of news gets out. And, of course, for example, the latest one, which I don't believe was officially acknowledged by either China or North Korea, there was this mysterious situation last month where North Korea said Kim Jong-un was going to attend the big 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, you know, affair, celebration that China was putting on. Big deal. Most countries sent somebody. All of a sudden, I think 2 weeks before, North Korea says, no, we're not going. Now, there was no official word from either North Korea or China as to why, what was going on. Well, you know the story is eventually going to get out. And what it was Kim Jong-un said, initially, I'll go. And then his people were saying, now, where's he going to stand for the big, you know, parade? We assume he's going to stand right next to, Mr. Xi, you know, the head of China. And then China says, no, he'll be in the back, you know, with all the other minor powers. Now, North Korea's always had this illusion that they're more important to China than they actually are. I mean, they just ignore the memo, as it were, ignore all the signs, China telling them, you know, well, I mean, historically, over 1,000 years, China has considered Korea the younger brother. In other words, the Koreans, like the Vietnamese, were always too much of a problem to invade and conquer and occupy. That's something the Chinese don't want to admit, but that's the way it works. However, if you will simply acknowledge that China is your big brother and you won't do anything to really annoy them, they won't come in and burn the place down. China will do that on occasion, you know, if you push them too far. At least in the past. China's been telling the Koreans, especially the Kims, that it's a hereditary dictatorship in Korea. We're working on the third generation now. He's telling them, look, you got problems in the 90s after the Cold War ended. Russia stopped sending these huge food and cash subsidies and oil subsidies they were sending you ever since, you know, the Korean War ended in 1953. It's what's been keeping you afloat. It disappeared. Big famine. 10% of the population dies of starvation and disease. North Korea insists, despite the fact that China's economy is booming. Remember, through the 90s, that was quite recently, the Chinese GDP was increasing 10% every year. That's why they're now the second largest economy on the planet. And the Chinese were telling the Koreans, look, you don't have to give up your dictatorship. We still have a police state in China. He says you just got to let loose your businessmen and control them, you know, let them know there's an arrangement to be made. Businessmen are businessmen. The ones who aren't, just shoot them. The North Koreans says, no. Basically, North Koreans didn't trust their own people. You know, China, Deng Xiaoping, you know, the guy in the 80s who basically got this all started, he says, look, we're Chinese, we're reasonable people. We've had a century of war and devastation. It's time to get rich. I mean, he literally said, to get rich is glorious. And that's all a lot of Chinese needed to hear. And a lot of them got rich. Now, North Korea simply wouldn't go along with that. In the meantime, North Korea is still going on the policies that they developed, you know, actually in the late 1940s. They wanted to invade and conquer South Korea and unite Korea. Now, something we forget historically is that the United States had the same problem with the South Korean government. They wanted to invade North Korea. And the main thing that was keeping them back was, A, we wouldn't give them enough military aid, and B, we said, look, we'll cut you off completely. Now, we had pulled all our troops out by the time of the mid-1950 when the North Koreans invaded. And they only invaded because Russia said, Stalin basically said, I think it would be a good idea, I'll send you a bunch of tanks and a whole bunch of ammunition, go unite Korea for us. Of course, we know how that worked out. Anyway, North Koreans never got off that idea that their defeat, despite 500,000 dead Chinese soldiers in that invasion, that stalemate at, you know, that's where the border is now, the military zone, was any significant message. They thought eventually, you know, we'll get stronger and stronger. They believe their own BS. I mean, it's always a big mistake to believe your own press releases. And that's what the North Koreans are doing. Now, not only were they believing, continuing to believe their own nonsense, even though the Russian subsidies went away, people were starving, their economy is just a mess. You know, it's a fraction of what the South Korean economy is. Most North Koreans now know that. And they have had to slowly loosen. They have a tendency to make the worst possible decisions. You know, it's like the old saying, you know, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And so what they've done is created a situation where they've ticked off, they've really annoyed their best and only remaining ally, China. Last year, China told them, if there's a war, you get into a war, we will not automatically come to your assistance. Now, for over half a century, the Chinese regularly renewed that pledge. We will come to your assistance. They said no more. They kept cutting back on the aid. They were still giving more oil. That's the only reason any lights at all are on in North Korea, because some Chinese oil was being delivered. Food, Chinese wouldn't give the supply all the food they needed. In other words, the Chinese were trying to slowly persuade them that their bankrupt policies were literally bankrupt. North Koreans weren't listening. Now they've reached a point, as Austin pointed out, that the North Koreans did the unthinkable. They blinked. They got into a confrontation with South Korea. Now, they knew the South Koreans, again, as Austin explained, because of the 2010 attacks and what have you, and the change in attitude in the South. That was a generational thing, by the way. The generation that went through the Korean War knew what the communists, whatever, the North Koreans were like. And they wanted no part in anything, you know, any deals with these guys, because the Northerners don't make deals. They simply look for a weakness and exploit it. And so the younger generation comes up and says, look, let's try sweetness and light. And as Mr. Chamberlain discovered with Hitler, it don't work out too well. So the South Koreans had an epiphany in 2010, and they told the North Koreans, and the North Koreans basically thought, they're wimps. They've always been wimps. They're going to continue to be wimps. Well, they haven't been wimpy lately. And this latest incident, basically the South Koreans basically told China, if they start shooting, we will burn them down. Now, this is a big deal in South Korea, because even though the North Korean military has enormously declined since the 1990s, very little new equipment, no fuel for training, even the troops are on short rations now. They're hungry. Farmers around military bases are complaining that, you know, their fields are being robbed at night. They're getting literally robbed in their homes by rogue soldiers and what have you. The government's having a hard time keeping a lid on that. But the military is in no position to successfully invade South Korea anymore. But they still have the capability of doing enormous damage to Seoul, where you have like over a quarter of the population lives, where you have a large chunk of even more of the GDP is concentrated in and around Seoul, the capital city, which is within artillery range of the DMZ in North Korea. But the South Koreans have basically jointly agreed that we're not going to take it anymore. Push us, we'll push back. And what happened here was the North Koreans, they looked at China. China says, ain't nothing help, ain't no help coming from us. You know, they looked around, there was nobody else. You know, I mean, Cuba would say, rah, rah, go get them. You know, Venezuela, you know, would cheer them on. Iran, he said, hey, guys, go for it. But that was it. And they realized they were all alone. Now, the big problem here, which we haven't mentioned yet, is China and South Korea, despite their burgeoning economic relationships, have one major dispute. What happens if the North Korean government collapses? As Austin pointed out, the South Koreans are aware that it's going to be very expensive if they're going to rebuild North Korea. The South Koreans, especially for the last 10 years, they've been carefully studying what happened in Germany when Germany, West Germany basically bailed out East Germany. We realized North Korea is in much worse shape than East Germany ever was, and it would be much more expensive. They also had the experience there, something like 28,000 North Koreans had escaped, as it were, from North Korea and made their way to South Korea, where they're accepted with open arms, with a cold shoulder by a lot of, you know, regular rank and file South Koreans. But they basically collected a lot of information on the mental state of these refugees, and a lot of them are damaged goods. I mean, this is no surprise. If somebody living in a kind of Stalinist police state, I mean, they out-Stalined Stalin as far as running a wicked police state goes. And it's done a lot of damage, not just to the economy, but to the psyche, you know, the mental health, as it were, of the North Korean people. So the South Koreans and Chinese have an unresolved dispute here over who is going to take over. Now, China is stronger. Apparently, the United States says we're not going to start World War III over North Korea. Who's going to basically pick up pieces there? So you work out what you can with China. The current deal that is more likely to happen, not that North Korea, South Korea agrees with it, is that if North Korea collapses, North Korea will become a wholly owned protectorate of China. In other words, it'll still be independent. They'll basically put in there are a lot of pro-Chinese North Koreans who Kim Jong-un has been executing and locking up in labor camps over the last 3 years since he took over. He's aware of it. I mean, it's no secret what's going on up there. But, you know, that may still, you know, blow up in everybody's faces. But for the moment, things are not going well for North Korea. And people complain, well, yeah, we've been predicting the end of North Korea for decades. Well, that's true. You know, I was predicting the end of the Soviet Union for over a decade before it went poof. And, you know, I get into big arguments with people I knew down the CIA and what have you. But I had numbers. I says, look, I says, you know, people on Wall Street agree with me. You know, it doesn't add up. Something's got to give. And suddenly in 1989, East Europe, communism went poof. And much to a lot of people's surprise, but not to mine and a lot of people in the intelligence community, it just wasn't fashionable to come out and say it. Except I did it in print, you know, and a lot of people in the CIA appreciated that. But saying, hey, look, this nut job up in New York, Dunnigan, he printed it here, and he's pretty reliable on other things. But then in 91, the Soviet Union just went poof, and that came as a big surprise. And they were partying down in Langley, believe me. But anyway, the problem with these dictatorships is they're there until, poof, they're not. And what people worry about in North Korea is that the poof there can be very messy. I mean, the Eastern European communism and the Soviet Union went with a whimper, not with a bang. But there's always a chance that things could get real ugly real fast, and they do have nukes. So one still has to worry about North Korea, not what they would do, but what would happen in their aftermath.
Right. Right. So it looks like it's going to be something. It's just going to be a continuing soap opera there on the Korean Peninsula.
Oh, it's a nuclear soap opera.
And the news media loves it because on a slow news day, there's always news North Korea.
Yeah, Jim, tell them about the Chacos.
Oh yeah, one of their North Korean efforts to basically get the economy going was to establish a free business zone in North Korea for South Korean firms. This was about 5 to 10 years ago, and so about 100 firms were basically they hire North Koreans for much less than they pay South Koreans. The North Korean government keeps 90% of the pay, but the North Koreans are still getting more money than they would. No, with a North Korean firm, and the only problem was that there were a lot of labor rules. One of which was you could not reward exceptional workers. Now this was taken for granted in South Korea. If you were good, you got rewarded. If you were not so good, you got fired. So the South Koreans realized, all right, we can't give them money, but we can give them snacks. Because there are very few snacks up in North Korea. There are some Chinese ones which are okay, but they're Chinese. But the South Koreans are Koreans, and they took the old 1920s, I think, when they first came out, moon pie, and in southern United States, basically a chocolate, you know, confection type pie. They're still very popular. There's a lot of them, you know, stuff like that still bouncing around. It's, you know, a secret delight for a lot of people. And they sell for less than 50 cents, you know, U.S. in South Korea, and as low as a quarter. And the North South Korean managers of these factories in the industrial zone up in North Korea found out by giving out these chocobo pies, it was a big deal. Not just because the workers liked the taste of them, but because they sold for the equivalent of a buck, which is big money in North Korea, on the black market. So the North Korean government said this is a direct challenge to our idea that this is a workers' paradise. So they basically banned the choco pie, and they tried to make their own. It was a dismal failure. You know, they imported goods, you know, from China, some of the technology. They set up the factory. It was a huge embarrassment, and now they're being smuggled in, and they're even more dangerous, you know, than they ever were before. But that's typical of what goes on in the workers' paradise in North Korea.
So in North Korea, South Korea, we won't have the soccer war, but we will have the moon pie war.
Well, it's like the old saying goes, situation desperate, send chocolate.
Right. Right.
Well, look, all right. South Korea's won the moon pie war.
They had the snacks. They got lots more than moon pies.
No, but my point, Dan, is that the military aspect is not...
that too, yes.
I have one more comment. Jim has the right, earned the right, to call attention to the fact that he saw the demise of the Soviet Union. But, Jim, I remember reading this, I want to say, in the late 70s, a short book called Will the Soviet Union Survive 1984? And I'm doing this off the top of my head. I remember that the fellow who wrote it was accused of being a fantasist or whatever, and he took 1984, of course, from George Orwell's book. Dan, there were people out there, when the point about the brittleness of dictatorships, that's one reason they are so screaming paranoid, because they know it. And they're the books out and people saying, you know, they're in decline, and the Russians saying anything but. And some of their apologists here in the United States, including the noted economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who I think it was 1984 when he said that the Soviet people were happy with their system. Totally wrong. No, he did.
The New York Times agreed with him.
Oh, yeah, they did. And so, Dan, we get to point that out. It's uncomfortable, isn't it? All right.
Okay. Well, we need to wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Take care. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.